Will you have an egg, Albert, or something else?
A boiled egg, please, my love. A boiled egg, please,
will you have an
love.
Egg, Albert?
A
or something else?
Egg, please, my
going
love.
Going for a walk, Albert?
Yes, going for a
poached
walk.
Poached egg on toast?
A boiled egg, please, my love.
Have a biscuit.
A boiled egg, please, my love.
And see the roses.
Albert?
A boiled egg, please, my love.
What about an egg, Albert?
Oh, now, a good recipe for eggs.
Give me all it.
On the roses, my chap. Very good, Miss.
I am a walking television show. I can't get away from them.
My name is Gurney Slade. I did a television show recently and they didn't think it was very funny. I'm being charged with having no sense of humour.
Oh. Just watch and keep your fingers crossed.
I wasn't supposed to do anything like this.
You say this is a stage. What's it for?
This is where we perform the show.
You perform the show, of course, of course.
Of course, of course, of course, of course.
What great air conditioning. You could easily develop a very good, nasty mind, you know. Why don't you go and see one of those French films? There's one on at the Rexy this week.
You're going to have a party. Let's have a mad party.
Why didn't you stop indoors and watch the television?
Nothing on, just some bloke telling kids a story.
Huh? Well, I hope he's doing better than me.
Leave me alone, will you? I got a right to me privacy. I just walked out of all this. I don't want to know. Now, leave me alone.
This is the first and possibly the last gathering of the four just men, or the four men just, to coin Johnny Spade's gag for Frankie Howard. We're four obsessed and obsessive fans and archivists of cult film, TV, radio, theatre and everything else that entertains you. And we're going to get together on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis, whatever the mood takes us, to talk about a particular obscure TV series or film or production we love, and an actor, writer, or director who played a major part in that production. And for this first attempt, we are picking Tony Newley, who was an actor, a director, and a writer. And the TV show is his bizarre masterpiece, The Strange World of Gurney Slade. And I'm going to ask Jonathan first, because you're fairly new to this. I mean, I remember seeing that my first experience of the Gurney Slade show was back in the early 90s, when one episode, the first episode, was on TV Heaven on Channel 4. And my dad was a massive fan of the show when it was first shown in the 60s. But you're fairly new to it only via the network release from last year, aren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I watched the TV Heaven season back in the day. Frank Muir, wasn't it, presenting it, hosting it?
That's right.
And I kind of honed in at that time on the ITC stuff. That's kind of what I knew, the Prisoner and I suppose the higher profile stuff like The Saint and stuff like that. And the things around it I kind of missed out. So Gurney Slade, I can't even remember that being on. So when I heard this was coming up from Network, it was just a, what's this? I had no idea what it was, but thought I'd take a punt on it. And of course there was a bit of buzz on Twitter about it as well. I think probably Walter was saying something about it. And then it arrived in the post and my mind was blown and it was just like, what the hell is this? Because being a Prisoner fan for so many years, we're sort of led to believe that it's one of the most unique series ever made, and it does all these amazing things, and you know, it's so out there. And then you see this program that was made years before it, and you think, wait a minute.
That was the cliche thing, wasn't it? That was the sort of hook they hung certainly the repeat on Channel 4 and also the network. It was Monty Python meets the Prisoner, but as you say, this was a good 10 years before either of those shows. Yeah. So. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And Walter, how did you hear about it? Did you see it back in the day too? Or
TV Heaven for me as well. God bless it. I mean, I'd pretty much hold that season responsible for kickstarting my interest in so many things. But I do remember sitting watching it, going, "What in the name of God is this?" And then desperately wanting to see the rest, and just thinking, "Never will." And then lo and behold, Network, bless their little cotton socks, come up with the goods. And just it was love. I mean, the pilot episode, or rather the first episode, doesn't really do it justice, does it? I mean, that's possibly the most straightforward episode of the five.
Yeah.
Six, sorry. It just gets better and better and better. And by the time we reached episode six, I was like, yeah, this is...
I mean, but also, bizarrely, the fact it gets better and better is because it was so off the wall and the audiences were dwindling so rapidly that they sort of curtailed it, didn't they? So Newley had to just wrap it up. So those last two episodes are really... you know, him trying to explain to the BBC, the ITV bosses, rather, you know, what he's trying to do with this programme, and that's why it's so good, you know, but...
I suppose we should introduce it a bit as well, in case people haven't seen it. And who wants to try and attempt to explain what it's about?
Okay.
Frank, you.
It's hard, isn't it?
Right, okay. I suppose the best way I think I can describe Gurney Slade is that it's an existential stream of consciousness set of six episodes featuring Anthony Newley, who at the beginning of the six episodes walks away from what looks like a role in a sitcom and then goes on a kind of odyssey of self-exploration, which also includes exploring kind of like television, but using film grammar, because it was all shot on film rather than being made in front of an audience as normally a sitcom would be made. And whether you can call it a sitcom is, again, a moot point, or whether you call it just a series is, again, debatable. But that's kind of what it is. It's kind of this, an exploration of him as a person, as Anthony Newley, as a celebrity, but also about what's going on in his head, what's happening in the wider world in terms of the power of advertising, in terms of, again, his response to how television and how film works. So that's kind of how I would introduce it. But that doesn't really do it justice, because it's just brimming over with such inventiveness that it's difficult to explain.
How can you tell anyone about the strange world of Gurney Slade? I don't know what it's about, and I'm in it.
I mean, to cut to the chase, there's sequences where he's talking to a rock, and sequences where he's having a conversation with a dog, and then he has a dance with the girl from the advertising poster, who's Una Stubbs, with a vacuum cleaner. It's this whole sort of surrealist, as you say, Frank, it's the whole sort of surrealism of Tony Newley's reaction to fame and reaction to the media and reaction to the world around him, isn't it? And it's just, you're allowed to enter his head for 26 minutes, and it's a roller coaster experience. I absolutely... Yeah. Brilliant piece of television.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing I would say about it, of course, is it's an early example of someone, I think, who knows he's in a television series as well. I mean, that amazing opening sequence to episode two, where the camera swoops down across the airstrip and goes right up to his shoulder where he's standing with his back to the camera. He just turns around and goes...
Took you long enough to get here, didn't it?
And then the episode actually starts.
It's one of the first examples of breaking the fourth wall, isn't it? It's that kind of whole idea of the star of the show actually talking to the audience through the television screen and actually saying, this is a television program, but I'm actually talking to you as well at the same time.
And I get goosebumps even now just thinking of that moment when he just does the finger movement in the air and the music starts. It's just like you're Newley is almost the conductor of the whole thing, isn't he? I mean, it's just it's brilliant. And you say you're breaking the boundaries of TV. I mean, there was stuff before the coronation, which I suppose is the major point of when TV became a natural thing to have in your house. I mean, obviously, Terry Thomas was doing the show How Do You View, in the late 40s, which was sort of doing the similar sort of thing. He was playing with the convention of TV in its infancy. But Newley was in a world of great sitcoms, but not sitcoms that were pushing domestic barriers like Hancock or The Army Game, those sort of things. What Newley was doing was really saying, you know, we're just making a TV show here, and it's ridiculous. And it was, I don't think anybody's ever done it since, really, in such the way that he did it. It's just
I think most of the reviews that have been written about it, people pick up on the fact that it was ahead of its time then, and it still is, I think. I mean, there's a point in one of the extras on the DVD where he's talking to the poster, and he says something about, you know, what is it he says about you know, you were ahead of your time.
We did our best, but it didn't quite work out and that sort of thing. Yeah.
He was like, yeah, you're ahead of your time. And he says, I don't think I'll ever be in your time.
Well, it was a noble effort, wasn't it? You tried, I'll give you that, you tried. But the public is no man's fool, you know. The public knows what it wants. And you had no right to even try and suggest something different. Anyway, the public doesn't like anything suggestive. He thinks you were before your time. Personally, I don't think we're ever going to reach the time that you're in. Of course, I realize that somebody's got to try something new on television. Got to cross new horizons and pioneer new lands and blaze new trails. But you see, they've got all that on wagon train. And I will say that for the public. They do know a Flint McCulloch when they see one. But I agreed to go along with you. I didn't have to, but I did. I was beginning to get a nice little name with the public too, you know. My records were beginning to sell like hotcakes. Of course, they didn't taste as good, but they were selling as well. You know, I had them all swinging with songs like, If I Say I Love You, do you remember? And I'll Never Let You Go. Why? They don't write them like that anymore. Do you remember? But I agreed to go along with you, but just as an experiment. But you can't argue with the public. As a performer, I have a certain duty towards the public. You see? Anyway, I promised that when you went away that I'd do a show in your memory. I think after everything you and I went through together, it's the least I could do. If I could think of anything less to do, I would do it. But anyway, listen, I promised that I would do a show in memory of your passing. And I think I can promise you that it'll be every bit as good as Gurney Slade, if not worse. Now, but wait a minute. I'm not going to do it the way you want it. Oh, no. This time we're going to do it the way they want it.
So they showed that at the NFT when they launched it last year, 2011, and that was for the repeat when ITV showed it again in 1963 and newly came in to do these little promos. And that's probably one of my favourite DVD extras of all time. I just Absolutely. Think they're brilliant, those. I mean, they're just so knowing again. Mm-hmm. But I suppose in a way we should talk about a bit about Newley's history. I mean, briefly, I mean, because he was sort of an Orson Welles figure, that even at that point, a very young man who was on the verge of writing a hit musical, and he'd been an actor since he was a child, and he was writing songs and performing songs, and he was a sort of a pop star at that time. But I mean, you know, he played the Artful Dodger for David Lean in Oliver Twist, and he appeared in Peter Ustinov's film Vice Versa, and he, you know, he'd done loads of stuff before Gurney Slade, and he was 28, 29 when he did that. So he was a multi-talented chap, wasn't he?
And he could have. He was pretty mainstream, really, wasn't he? Before that, is that fair to say?
Rock and roll stuff.
Yeah. So to come,
yeah. I mean,
you could say that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was a well-known actor. I mean, he would do stuff like X, the Unknown for Hammer Films and those sort of stuff. I mean, he was a familiar face in the cinema. He did the odd TV series, radio shows and stuff. But his main goal at that time was to be a rock star, a pop star. Mm-hmm. And he did a film called Idle on Parade, which was, with knowing That's right. irony, in this country it was spelled L-I-D-L-E. But in America, it's spelled I-D-O-L to capitalise on the whole Elvis Presley in the Army thing. Mm-hmm. And in that film, he had two or three pop songs, which he performed, and they got in the top 10. And, you know, that was the start of that whole career, really. That was like 1958, 59 time.
This is a camp that is mighty tough for where the marching men are made. But I am a guy who doesn't dig that stuff, and I'm idle on parade. Come on, fellas, join in. There is a man, a Sergeant Major Lush, and he has got to be obeyed. Yeah. And in a voice just like a little thrush, he says, I'm idle on parade. Now when they gave me a rifle, well, they went too far. A much better.
And then around the time he was doing Gurney Slade, he was writing Stop the World, I Want to Get Off with Leslie Bricus. So he was doing loads of stuff, you know, real multimedia person.
Mm-hmm. And it's also worth mentioning that he'd done Cranks, which was that experimental four-person review in 1956, and he often cites that as a huge influence on what he did later. And I think that kind of feeds into what he did with Gurney Slade, because it was very inventive, very clever use of music and lyrics and surprise tactics to kind of hold the audience's attention. So I think that had a a big influence on him, and the guys who wrote that, John Cranko and John Addison, kind of had a huge influence on him, and certainly on how Gurney Slade, I think, turned out in the end.
Mm-hmm. And then the guys that ended up writing Gurney Slade, because it was devised by him, was it his idea? Do we know?
Well, it was Sid and Dick, wasn't it, really? I mean, it was Sid Green and Dick Hill who wrote it for him. Mm-hmm. So it was a three-way thing, but it's like, you know, Al Jolson would claim songwriting credits on his songs. He never actually wrote a note, but it was because he fashioned it and he delivered it and made it something completely different that he got credit for it. And I think that was the same way with Newley's thing, really.
Maybe yeah.
Sid and Dick. We won't start singing Boo Moo Yetta Tata here, but you can if you want to. Just for a little bit of light relief.
No, I mean, I would imagine that where Gurney Slade was concerned, there isn't one word of that Sid and Dick wrote that wasn't signed off on by Newley.
Mm.
I mean, it strikes me as a total three-way collaboration. I mean, obviously because it's his baby. I mean, it's totally Tony Newley. I can't imagine anybody else ever doing that, playing that part. So... I mean, Sid and Green wrote it, but I can imagine sort of hours of improvised conversation between the three of them, just going, right, what will we do this week? What are we going to do? And and then just shaping the result.
And you can't see anybody else having the clout in the business to get it made, can you, either? Because it was so off the wall, and because Newley was at the peak of so many different levels of show business at that time, you can understand them saying, okay, we'll have a punt on this because you're so famous. But anybody else, I don't think, you know...
Oh, no, they wouldn't have entertained it.
I can't see Benny Hill walking in and saying, let's do this at the BBC at that time, really, and get away with it, because he was just doing sort of bog-standard sitcoms and sketch shows at that time. So I think Newley had, as I say, the clout to actually, you know, challenge the conventions of what he was doing, really.
It was ATV, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, well...
And the talent directed it, yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. That'd be Lord Grade doing his traditional...
Yes, Lou Grade would have kind of said yes to that, wouldn't he? And mm-hmm. he was well known for kind of just putting, you know, writing a check out and saying, go and do it, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it's nice, you hear those stories... I hate that term, golden age of TV, but, I mean, from the 50s up until the... early 80s even, there was a real sort of freedom, wasn't there, where exec producers would say, yeah, go on, you know, they'd see talent and say, yeah, go and make a show and see what happens, you know, rather than going through long committees and is this cost effective? No, it doesn't matter, you know, we trust your talent, go and do it. And I think that was definitely Newley's, to Newley's credit, that he got away for six shows, really. That was quite an achievement.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at it now or rewatching it recently, I mean, I hope this doesn't seem like too obvious or too lazy a comparison, but the only other person I can think of who would have been capable of producing something as downright strange as this, it almost plays like Spike Milligan with a really strong script editor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, somebody controlling him and shaping it, and actually somebody who's got the strength to actually force it into some sort of direction. You know, it's that sort of mindset.
Yeah.
The sort of take, what's that great line about Milligan taking things to their illogical conclusion?
Exactly.
Yeah. And Absolutely. It also, for me, reminds me of Richard Lester's work as well, in terms of visuals. And obviously there's a great debt to Fellini as well, who I'm assuming, you know, Newley absolutely loved as well.
There are some great shots in it, aren't there? I mean, it's so cinematic, as you say, it's made on
very stylish.
It looks so beautiful. You can freeze frame a lot of it, and it just looks fantastic, which was pretty unique in those days of TV, certainly. But definitely Milligan. I mean, I remember I was doing a book on Monty Python about 10 or 12 years ago, and I asked all the Python members who influenced them, and Eric Idle said Tony Newley in The Strange World of Gurney Slade, but only in that, which he was very adamant about. It was only in that show he thought he was brilliant. The rest he didn't think much of at all. So, you know, obviously it was a great influence to the Python boys, you know, 7-8 years later.
I suppose there is that thing as well where they were concerned that, you know, maybe not even consciously, but the fact that they'd seen it and, you know, it was probably kind of working away... you know, part of sort of the melting pot and sort of heading towards what they eventually created. You know, it's like that, you know, Terry Jones says that thing about watching the Q series and going, my God, he's got there before us.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a light bulb moment, isn't it? I think you can imagine them sitting at home. They were in their late teens then, and thinking, my God, you can actually do that on TV. You know, that's how it works. And you can imagine them just thinking, I want to do that when I grow up, sort of thing. And I think in that, and also let's not forget, you know, Newley's influence on David Bowie as well. I mean, you know, his stylistic of a song, David Bowie has always cited him as his major influence. And if you hear the songs, I mean, some of them they're fairly twee and stuff, and they're nothing wrong in that. But you can hear the Bowie sort of twangs all the way through it, you know. And I love the fact he's this all-round entertainer, you know, wrapped up in this surreal genius, really.
Absolutely, and an astonishing supporting cast as well. I mean, I'm just looking at this. I mean, Annika Will, obviously, Douglas Wilmer, Charles Lloyd Pack,
Eunice Stubbs. Edward Richfield.
Yes, absolutely.
Hugh Paddock, don't forget Hugh Paddock. I love the fact as well that in episode 6, where they all come back, and Hugh's playing the lovely sort of fairy character, and of course he is. Who wouldn't he play a lovely fairy character? But Hugh Paddock in a pinstripe suit. But obviously he was busy on the 6th week, and they got Graham Starkin to play his part. But everybody else is the same, and it's like, my God, they've all come back for this episode, you know, just to sit there and just watch Newley evaporate with this ventriloquist dummy. It's just brilliant. And of course, Bernie Winters, who pops up in everything Newley did at that time. You know, Bernie Winters was his big Jewish showbiz pal, and they're the most incongruous pair, but they work together so well.
Well, that's something. I mean, I don't know if you still get this on television now. Is these little repertory companies that either just because they enjoy, you know, if it's star power, or whether it's kind of, you get this a lot with directors as well, where the same people keep turning up in various productions. You know, ITC, of course, it's famous for it, where, you know, the same actors show up playing different parts. I think mainly because they're a safe pair of hands, but also just because they really enjoy working together. And I think by the sound of it, if anybody who worked on this just went, yeah, this is great, whatever you want me to do on this, I'll do.
Well, it's that old gag, wasn't it? They used to say that, you know, and tonight it's the Alma Cogan show with guest star Bernie Winters, and tomorrow night it's the Bernie Winters show with guest star Alma Cogan. They would have that sort of pool of talent they'd always dip into. But you're definitely right, Walt. I mean, you know, they would go to these actors because they were bloody good at what they could do, and you could black up Warren Mitchell to play a sultan or something, Danger Man or something, and get away with it, you know. So, I mean, and there's such a fantastic array of talent, isn't there? I mean, they just were brilliant at what they did, and and I think as an actor, you're pleased to be given the opportunity to do something completely different, and that's what Gurney Slade was, certainly.
Yeah. One thing I was sort of wondering about the show, I mean, we all know that the first two episodes that were shown prime time, is that right? And then after that, it went about 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night.
Yeah,
but the way that the show, the episodes are made, it's as if they knew what was going to happen in the real world. Now, I'm guessing they weren't written week by week, were they? They're all filmed in advance. This is one thing. It's never been that clear.
As far as I'm aware, Johnny, I think the last two episodes were made when they were aware it was coming off.
Right.
Those last two, when it goes into a complete sort of Hades of madness, they knew what was happening, and they were given the opportunity to just sort of, like, you know, round it up quickly or get out, sort of thing.
Oh, but well,
the first four are fairly structured, aren't they? I mean, there's plots to the first four episodes.
So they sort of just saw it all. They were reading the papers, they were getting the memos, and they were thinking, right, that's it. Let's just make the most of it.
Well, it continues up to this day. I see this in a lot of American television series. There's a fine, fine tradition of series that get the cancellation notice and go, right. And then they just basically do all the stuff that they knew they were never going to be allowed to do if they'd been an ongoing series. I mean,
Pushing Daisies, for example.
Yes, absolutely. Angel being a perfect example. Where in the last series we have the episode where the central character's turned into a Muppet.
Yes.
For a start. Or Crusade, where they do an entire episode featuring aliens who are influenced by TV signals beamed from Earth years ago, and all they've become obsessed with is the X-Files, so they model their entire society on the X-Files. They'd never have away with that if that series was still ongoing.
Or even more annoyingly, sound like Dry, which just finishes, and that's like, what? You know, do you remember Drive after about three episodes,
yes,
or something? Nathan Fillion thing? I love that. At least in this country, it was back in the 60s, I think, it was almost a gentleman's agreement, you know, we'll give you these two episodes to explain what the hell you're trying to do here, and then that's it, it's goodbye,
yeah.
I think. The whole constriction of it, you know, just fired up the genius of Newley and Sid and Dick to come out with these two episodes, which I think are two of the most imaginative and spellbinding bits of TV you could ever see, actually. I mean, they are just phenomenally good in every detail. Mm-hmm. They just are so amazing to watch. And I mean, out of that, you know, adversity comes genius.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a certain melancholy to the last couple of episodes as well. If I remember rightly, it's been a few months since I watched it last, but does the last episode not begin on a massive tracking shot of sort of the lonely star sitting on his stool in the middle of the studio, abandoned by everybody?
Yeah, it's like a trial, isn't it? I mean, it's a trial pretty much, and all the characters who even if they've been in one episode for like 5 minutes, like Edwin Richfield's father character, you love that character. And the fact that he's got no other lines to say now, and he's got to be chipped off to Zed cars or something, you know, you actually feel sorry for this character. I mean, you've only met him once or twice. It's basically just deconstructing the whole, the whole quality of TV as you know, it's not built to last. It's fleeting, isn't it?
Well, there's that other bit, and again, one of those extras and the sort of little promos they must have had on at the time. And they were, he says, you know, I'm just going to sit here. He says, all television is a square standard lamp in the corner. I'm just going to sit here and they're just going to watch me. And that's kind of summing up a lot, I think, is that what television was turning into then? I mean, even then, I mean, now, of course, we could say that with Big Brother and Big Brother gets a mention, of course, not our Big Brother, but... episode one, there's a mention, but you know, even then they were sort of saying, okay, television, what, where's it going? And now we're still saying it.
I mean, you know, TV, it was a big deal. I mean, particularly once ITV started in 1955, the fact that, you know, the majority of the nation had a set in their living room, and it was a talk point. I mean, there's episodes of Hancock and episodes of Alf Garnett where you know the neighbors are pushing into the sitting room to watch television, so it was a major talking point. So I think the point of Newley's program is, you know, what are you doing? You're wasting your life just sitting here watching something we made. This is what it is, this is how we do it. You know, why don't you go out and talk to a rock instead? It's much more fun.
There's a wonderful bit in it's episode three, the Down on the Farm one, where Newley's chatting away to the dog, who of course thinks that he owns the humans and the other way around. And there's a fantastic melodramatic subplot being acted out in the background that he's ignoring completely. And I kind of like the idea that basically there's a film crew on the other side filming that, and he's just sort of sitting in the background as a background artiste completely.
I tell you what that reminded me of as well, Jacques Tati.
Whole
background thing going on in the background where he was, as he was talking to the dog, it was this just silent comedy going on, which was great. I think it's fantastic, very inventive.
Yeah, totally. It's just one of those series. It's why I'm a fan of archive television, old radio. Just a fan of.
Well, you're a fan of. I think more we're fans. Yes, we're fans of old. Of archive and old telly, but it's more discovering new telly that happens to be old, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of what we're doing. I think I'm not a fan of old telly just because it's old. I think people say that to you sometimes, or say that to me. It's like, why do you like old telly? And it's like, well, it's not so much that I like old telly. It's that there's always something new to come along, like Gurney Slade. I mean, Callan is another one that recently is, Walter will know, and anyone on Twitter, every time there's a sale that comes up now for Callan, I'm saying, buy it. But until a couple of years ago, until Network, God bless them, brought it out of mothballs, it's another thing I just completely missed. And
We'll do Woodward later on, John.
Yeah, okay.
We'll do the Woodward hour later. Okay,
he's episode two.
I mean, I always say when because I get these sort of quizzical looks. I do these talks at schools and things about my books and stuff, and you get sort of some smart aleck kid saying, "Well, why do you like all this old stuff?" I said, "No, it's not. I like the old stuff. I just like television, and you know, the fact it might have been made in 1961 doesn't matter. It's still good television. There's also some real bad TV made in 1961, and I'm not afraid to say that. But you know, you've got to like quality, and thank God for film, and thank God for vinyl that we preserve this stuff, and you know, for our generation and later and future generations can actually discover these great talents. I mean, because obviously, sadly, Newley's been long dead, but you know, the voice goes on, and I mean, I think, you know, time will out, and people whose minds are so inventive, and I think Gurney Slade is probably his comedy masterpiece, you know, thank God it's available. And as you say, our patron saint is pretty much Network DVD. I think I give most of my royalties to them. Tim, if you're hearing this, Tim Bellows. No, I think it's just a love of quality entertainment, isn't it, really?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
It's moments like this that I live for, where you plug in something like this and you've got no idea what you're expecting or what to expect. And then when you come out of it the other side, you just go, I am so bloody glad I now know about that.
Well, rewatching some of Gurney yesterday, it made me want to buy the DVDs for Christmas for people, you know, this year. Just to try and introduce other people to it. And they might just watch one episode, but even if they just watch it and then give it away again, maybe we should all maybe buy a copy. Everyone who listens to this podcast, buy a copy for a present and give it away. Or leave it on a bench somewhere.
That's what I did when the Beatles brought out Three as a Bird. I bought every member of my family a copy of that in 1994. It still only got to number two in the bloody charts because Michael Jackson beat it with Earth Song. But there we go. I did my best for the boys. But there we go.
And we can keep talking about Gurney a bit more. But also, Frank, you mentioned on Twitter yesterday you're reading the biography of Anthony Newley. And I just wondered have you got to the part? Has Gurney been mentioned? Is there any? Do we know what he thought after it got cancelled?
I actually skipped forward to see what was said about Gurney. There isn't actually a great deal said about it.
Right.
It's mentioned a little bit, but there's actually a much bigger chapter on Hieronymus. That actually he's linked in bits about Gurney into that. So I haven't quite got to that chapter yet, but that looks quite thorough in that he's looking at the script.
Okay. That's Garth Bradley's book, isn't it, bro?
That's right, yeah.
Which is extortionate on Amazon at the moment. It's about 50, 60 quid for that book.
Is it? I think it was... Oh, I've got it here. I should just leave it. Oh, hold on a second. So you published it. Oberon Books. It must have been the...
Yes, Oberon Books. Company. I've got an ex-library library book copy of it.
I got it for my birthday in 2003. There we go.
And it's very good. I've read so far. I've read about four chapters of it. And what a hell of an early life he had.
Well, is there anything that's jumped out at you about Newley, you know, about his life that's made you sort of think, you know, what's this book taught you that you maybe didn't know?
Certainly his early sort of upbringing and how, you know, he kind of persevered to kind of find himself out of a very sort of what you'd call a sort of in a way a broken family background, and actually wrote to the Conti school to actually get into the Conti school, the Italian Conti school, and from there that's how he's progressed. But until then he didn't really know what he was going to do. So it's been fascinating to find out about that.
So do you think Gurney is very much a... You know, are we sort of putting too much, you know, viewing it? What am I trying to say? Is that his mind? You know, is that
real?
Yeah, is that him? Is he?
It's, I'd say it is.
So, by that point,
I would too.
I sort of think it's not the sort of thing someone just comes up with one afternoon and think, oh, I'll just do a program like this.
I also think there's a kind of, especially within Gurney and some other projects, there's also a kind of... He's kind of very positive about the kind of a kind of childlike creative spirit, a sort of unfettered quality to creativity, and you can see that in Gurney, and you can see that in Hieronymus. You know, you can see those sorts of things happening, that where he's just playing an awful lot of the time, And that again goes back to childhood and kind of being inspired to paint and to write and to do his own thing. So I think there's a lot of that in there, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And again, for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about with Hieronymus Merkin, we should probably explain that one a little bit, shouldn't we? That's his name.
How long have we got?
Yeah. How do you explain it?
Well, again, first of all, the full title.
You better go and watch it.
First of all, the full title, which I'm going to read here because I forget it, is Can Hieronymus Merkin Ever Forget Mercy Hump and Find True Happiness? ? And that's 1969.
Mm.
So another, 10 years, about 10 years after Gurney. And that's
very much cut from the same cloth, isn't it?
It is.
It is.
Don't say we didn't warn you about a motion picture that is definitely not for everyone. Can Hieronymus Merkin ever forget Mercy Hump and find true happiness? Extremely sensuous and revealing. It took Playboy magazine 10 pages to show it all. They called it a zany erotobiography, the wackiest film yet. This picture is exactly what it pretends to be. Exciting, realistic, and so natural that it makes blow-up look like Shirley Temple in Little Miss Marker, wrote Los Angeles Herald Examiner. A hair-raisingly candid film, erotic epic, Newsweek. A sort of what's new pussycat brought up to today's level. Filmed in the new style, slick cinema, bright wit, satiric barbs. Judith Crist, New York Magazine. Merkin is a ribald, yeasty movie, Detroit News. Extra care is taken at this theater so that nobody under the age limit posted in lobby will be admitted. Can Hieronymus Merkin ever forget Mercy Hump and find true happiness?
That's one of the movie titles that are this kind of, I know off by heart for the simple reason that I used to use it as a way of testing film guides or whatever to see how comprehensive they were. You know, if they had that in,
good idea.
Yeah, you know, the other one being, and I'll see if I can still remember it, Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hung You in the Closet and I'm Feeling So Sad. If it's got that, then it's comprehensive. So I sort of knew about it long before I ever saw it.
And right, okay, Walter, you describe that film for us. Sum it up.
What, Hieronymus Merkin?
Ah, just sum up in a sentence.
What, I can do it in one word. Cracked.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cracked. Indescribable, quite frankly. It's one of those that you just have to see, I think. You may not like it, but you'll be glad you've had the experience of watching the damn thing. Again, like Gurney Slade, there's nothing like it. It's just incredible. I mean, how many films do you know with characters like with the names like Polyester Poontang, the side of Goldfinger?
And Bruce Forsyth as well.
It was also the sort of the death now for his career was in terms of film, wasn't it? He didn't make another film for a long time after that, and he was never in as much control again. But he was one of these darlings of the 60s, wasn't he? I mean, we should sort of fill in a few gaps. Obviously, he wrote the lyrics to Finger with Leslie Bricus. He'd been on Broadway with Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, and that had also been played on Broadway by Sammy Davis Jr., Tony Newley's original part of Little Chap. So he become this American star as well. And that had given him a sort of broader canvas and more money to play with. So the film really was the Technicolor 2-hour version of Gurney Slade, wasn't it?
I don't know. It reminds me that, you know, although the two films are completely unlike each other, but if anybody's ever seen Skidoo, it just feels like a total throw everything at a wall and see what sticks.
With Groucho Marx's God.
That's the very chap. And yeah, sung end credits as well. Yes. But, you know, it's kind of the freedom when you reach a certain point to pursue a major vanity project. I mean, that was Otto Preminger, if I remember rightly. Awful Otto Preminger. It's the sort of thing where, you know, the time, everybody would just scratch their heads and go, well, that's it, that's it, his career. But years later, people go back and go, no, hang on a minute.
Well, I'll tell you. You're looking at a monument to my first 40 years. This shrine, this hallowed pile, is a complete pictorial, literary, and sound history of my life. It has been ruthlessly recreated from the truth. this edifice, this orchestrated pyramid of my most intimate secrets, leaves tomorrow for the Hieronymus Merkin Museum. Recently built on the grounds of the Jette Lipschitz Academy for the Performing Arts. It's important the writers of history have access to this material, so that when they come to set down the story of my life, they have the facts, my darlings. The plain, bare-bottomed facts.
He was also in a particularly dog of a musical the year before, Dr. Doolittle, which I love, but, you know, was considered the poor man's Mary Poppins at that time. And he did an album of all the songs, again, that were Leslie Bricker's composed songs. He was doing things that he loved to do and was very impassioned about, but they weren't being very popular. And I think he got a fairly deserved reputation of being a problem to work with and a person that would not take direction. So, you know, in a way, he was his own worst enemy, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's just when his last role was EastEnders, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, it's when you think about, you know, I'm not going to sit here and put down EastEnders because some of the finest television performances I've ever seen have come out of soap operas. I mean, the production line thing of kind of producing incredible work continues to this very day. I mean, your average EastEnders two-hander can be as riveting as anything that you'll ever see. But whenever you were kind of a huge, huge Broadway star or whatever, and then you end up sort of back on the treadmill at the very end of your career, I mean, you just wonder what must go through someone's head, you know, when you were the darling of the 60s.
Yeah, I think he was just bloody grateful to get the work, actually. Not on his uppers, but he wanted some work. And, I mean, the only reason he didn't continue in that role was because he was very ill. Mm-hmm. He did, I think, 3 episodes or something. But the very last job he did was in series 2 of The Lakes, when he played the bishop, when the vicar, played by Robert Pugh, has been sent up to see the bishop for having sex with one of his parishioners. And Tony Newley is the bishop with like a 3-minute sequence, and it is the most truthful, relaxed, bewitching performance you could ever see. He is just fantastic in it, and this man is a dying man. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing. I think it's in the last episode or the episode before last, but it's not even a cameo. It's even small enough. It's not even that. It's just a few lines, but he's fabulous in it. And I just think he knows it's his last work. You can just tell in the eyes. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, goodbye. And it's very emotional.
Yeah. It's not often that people actually get the chance to say goodbye on camera. Mm-hmm.
No.
It's one thing I was going to say is, you know, he's not altogether forgotten. I mean, obviously, we all remember him, but it's... you know, his songs keep turning up. I mean, Muse covered Feeling Good fairly recently.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's from The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, Candyman from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is another one that kids will know, the Candyman song, which he wanted to do himself in the song, but didn't in the end, in the film, rather. But, yeah, no, I mean, we're not saying he's forgotten at all, but, I mean, I think... The pure scale of what he achieved in a relatively short amount of years, mm-hmm. It's phenomenal, isn't it? I mean, the stuff he did, you know, amazing, really. So I think, yeah, he's probably remembered. I mean, I saw him twice. I saw him once do Scrooge, which was a Leslie Bricker's musical of Christmas Carol, obviously, playing Scrooge up in Birmingham at the Alexandra Theatre in the early 90s when John Pertwee was playing Marley's Ghost. And I saw him again, must have been nearly before he died, around 97 maybe, doing cabaret at the Café Royal on Regent Street. And he was just doing all the old hits and musical numbers, and it was just unbelievable. A very small space with this legend, you know,
mm-hmm.
just going through his old repertoire. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of whenever you're in close quarters with someone that presumably you're kind of, I don't know, for want of a better phrase, the sort of star power of someone like that.
Charisma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The atmosphere sparkles. the fact that you're just in there with the person who's so good, but it's so relaxed and so effortless, you know, with him particularly. It was amazing. So I'm very pleased to have seen him do that. But I mean, yeah, as you say, you know, well, the songs are always on the radio, and he had an amazing way with songs. He, almost the first few he did were covers of Lloyd Price rock and rolls and Frankie Avalon sort of ballads and stuff. But he just, the way he delivered it, and he has some great arrangers. Eric Rogers, who wrote the Carry On music later on, was one of his first guys, and people like Johnny Gregory and Ian Fraser, these really good arrangers. I mean, the songs are brilliant. So they're, you know, a Radio 2 staple forevermore.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And he almost made an obviously record with Dear Derbyshire. What more can you say?
you default there, Frank, for being the first person to mention anything alluding to Doctor Who.
I couldn't resist.
We got away with nearly 15 minutes there. Without...
We can do this, boys. We can do this. We don't have to mention it.
Well, the other film I was watching yesterday was The Small World of Sammy Lee, which, you know, we've mentioned the sort of slightly, well, very bonkers world of Gurney Slade and Merkin, but this, I think we've all probably seen this one, haven't we?
Yeah.
Which is a very much the down-to-earth performance, and it just showed, so as well as all this kind of crazy stuff, he could actually do the more serious, which was, it's a lovely little film about this kind of, this compere, CD, he's not CD, but the world he's in really, in Soho, in London in 1963, he's working in this little club run by Robert Stevens, and his world just starts to kind of collapse around him over the space of about 24 hours, when the money that he's borrowed, is it £300, I think he owes some local gangsters, suddenly this debt is called in. And he has
now,
to try.
Hang on.
Oh, yeah.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, isn't there a Mickey Rooney film from the early 50s, basically about someone whose world unravels in a day because of a foolish investment choice? You punted a copy at me a while back. I'm just
one of the film noirs. Was it an old noir?
Yeah.
Quicksand.
Yeah, downhill.
Was it?
When he plays the jockey.
Quicksand.
Oh, God.
Quicksand, yeah, I think it was. But this, but anyway, so it's just that it's a lovely little film. It takes place in a very small part of London, just a few sort of streets, really, I think. And you see London in 1963, the rainy, kind of dirty streets on a Sunday morning, and but I watched it first a few years ago. There's a box set, the London. I think it's the London collection. There's about five or six films in there, it's. I think that's the only way you can buy it at the moment, and it's just one of my sort of new favourites, really. And again, it goes back to this thing of discovering something new that is, well, something old that is new to me. And
yeah, there was a whole sort of glut of those films. I mean, stuff like The Comedy Man with Kenneth Moore, when films were again looking at the underbelly of London and the show business world, weren't they? I mean, there was a real rebellion, I think. I mean, sort of the Philip Larkin thing. I mean, 63 was a turning point, as you say, Newley was doing it in Gurney Slade 3 years earlier, but by that time the rest of the world had sort of caught up with him. And he could sort of try and address those more serious issues, couldn't he, in films. He did a lot of good films at that time. Again, loads of films with Bernie Winters. They weren't all sort of wacky comedies, but there was some great stuff. I mean, this the film called Let's Get Married, which is dealing with abortion, and it was sold as a bright and breezy comedy with a couple of new songs, but it's some pretty hard hitting themes in there too. And another one called In the Nick, when he's in prison, not as an inmate but as a worker there, and there's people like Jimmy Booth and Bernie Winters in prison. So I mean, he was doing some interesting films. He wasn't just going to take the easy buck and do some wacky comedies. He was more willing to explore, you know, unusual avenues.
Well, he was a great actor. I mean, just watching this, you feel for him when he's on the phone begging for his almost for his life, because he thinks he's going to get beaten to a pulp, and who knows how he's going to come out of it. And it's really quite touching. Great stuff.
I take it we've all heard his original version of Goldfinger, just as an aside.
Indeed. Yeah.
We had rights between the split in, haven't we? And I want to play it for you.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's again, you know, the fact that...
That was a slight reaction there.
Okay. Sorry about that. Pardon me. But it's just, again, you know, it's that this man had so many strings to his bow, he needs an entire orchestra.
Mm.
You know, it's, you know, John's talking about, him playing this character in 63. It's 63 for that, isn't
it?
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, he's writing songs for James Bond movies, and he's on the stage, and you know,
I think it's sad that there is no, not that I know of anyway, an Anthony Newley collection. Rather, you know, we've got all these box sets for Peter Sellers, of course, and Terry Thomas, and all the Hollywood actors.
Certainly for his music, you can certainly get his music.
But when it comes to films, you know, it's a bit sad that there isn't, just because we're talking about maybe him perhaps falling out of public consciousness. I would say a lot at the moment. You talk to people now that are fans of films, and they might, well, depending who they are, of course, but younger viewers certainly probably wouldn't quite know who he was. So I think it maybe needs someone to, one of these DVD companies like Odeon.
I think the problem is, I think although the films are really good, they're not that familiar. Probably the only one that people know is Dr. Doolittle. The only one that's on TV, you know, every 18 months or so. That's the one that gets fairly regular exposure. The others, they're mainly, you know, black and white, not B films, but they're black and white sort of British films that have not had the exposure that other films of that era have had, really. So the way you could sell it is, as you say, do a lovely Anthony Lee box set. Some clever person should have done it on the back of The Gurney Slave, because The Gurney Slave was the surprise seller of 2011. So that would have been a way of trying to launch some stuff. But no, it's strange, isn't it? You mentioned the Sammy Lee. You're right, it's only available on that box set, isn't it? You can't buy that as a single release. No,
yeah, and the box set's about £30. I managed to get it. It was in the BFI shop, I think, last year. And I've been waiting for years for this thing to drop in price, and it never does. So I thought, I'll buy it for £25 or whatever. But
he's one of those lovely little treats, though. He's a sort of more high-profile Sam Kidd in a way, because you're watching someone like, I don't know, Murder, She Wrote, and he pops up as a Scotland Yard detective, or, you know, he Newley did loads of stuff like that. He would just nip in to do a Merv Griffin show, or, as Walt pointed out last week, Hollywood Squares or something, you know. He was one of these people that just would appear on anything. And Sammy Davis Jr., he would just, you know, do his song and whatever and get off.
And YouTube is kind of the Anthony Newley Anthony Newley fan's friend at the moment, isn't it? Because you Google, you go into YouTube and search for Anthony Newley, and all these little performances pop up. One of which is the Bob Down show. There's the comedian Bob Down pops up in Edinburgh once in a while. I went to see him last year, and he was, I asked him about working with Anthony Newley, because he was talking about he did a New Year show. I think it was 1996.
Yeah,
Bob Down did the show, and and he asked him on, and I just asked him briefly afterwards, and he just said how privileged, how honoured he was that Anthony Newley came on, because he was kind of his idol. All this stuff is on YouTube, so there is stuff out there, and maybe
I think YouTube is everybody's fan's friend, really, isn't it? You could search. From putting anybody in there, and I spent far too many months of my life sort of like in a darkened room with my laptop, googling people on YouTube and finding, you know, wonderful stuff. So yeah, it's out there certainly, but I mean, it's just
BFI
just down
should
to
really
down to
do
people.
A flip side of Hieronymus Merkin. Definitely.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Be perfect for that range. I'm really surprised I haven't actually latched onto that already.
It is exactly up their street.
And that's a film that I only heard about for the first time last week when we were chatting last week, and you mentioned it.
You see, Johnny, you've been in the dark all this time.
Absolutely, but
you didn't read my review.
Now, I'm just looking at the IMDb entry for that. So it was distributed, Hieronymus Merkin was distributed by Universal. Now, I'm just wondering if there's some sort of license hell that it's fallen into, because, I mean, you know, there are various notable absences on DVD shelves in terms of television series, but I'm sure there's films as well that are just stuck for one reason or another because somebody's saying no or whatever. But
well, I know the Hammer films that were distributed by Columbia.
Yeah.
In that situation. So whether, I mean, because he did another thing set in New York called Sweet November, which I think was the year before that in 68, I think, or 67, which I think was also Universal. I'm not entirely sure. But I mean, that's another lovely performance. I mean, he's really good in that. And I've got that on, that was on TCM, I think, a few years ago. But I mean, you know, you can track these things down. And that's part of the fun in a way, isn't it? I've always believed if everything's out, there'll be nothing left to look forward to.
If you've
still got little treasures you can't wait to get hold of. I remember a friend of mine who was collecting, I think it was Picture Goer issues, magazines. And obviously that's a finite. You can get every issue of that and then that's it. And his sort of the light went out of his eyes when he got the last issue he needed. That was it. You know, I thought, oh, God.
Service is over.
So many different things. I mean, I'm never going to get everything. So
I never want the light to go out of my
eyes. That's cute for a song there, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
Oh, that's superb.
We should mention Joan Collins as well, shouldn't we? I suppose as we're talking about that film and about Newley's sort of spiral downwards, I suppose, in a way, because it was marrying her.
It's all linked, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was obviously an obsession on both their parts, and but they sort of still, although they had a torturous marriage, they always stayed friends, and they did a thing in the late 80s, Noel Coward thing called the Red Peppers together, which is really good. She's on Twitter, Joan Collins, and actually, funny, she was saying something about a week or two ago, saying that she's just newly decorated her bedroom, and she spelled Newley N-E-W-L-E-Y, which I thought was quite touching.
It's funny, of course, because, I mean, Sellers was going through a similar self-destructive relationship with a certain high-profile actress as well during the 60s. And Newley reminds me of Peter Sellers. Physically, he reminds me of Peter Sellers, but also sometimes in the kind of high-profile roles that he takes as well. Mm-hmm. You know, always happy and always willing to take a chance. I'm just looking at this review of Hieronymus Merkin, which rather damningly says, can Anthony Newley ever remember that he's just a pleasant, light comedian and settled down to earn an unpretentious living?
That is fabulous. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine him saying, screw you, quite frankly, at that, can't you?
Yeah. But
yeah.
Interesting. No, I agree with you. I mean, there's a wonderful record that Newley and Sellers did with Joan Collins called Fall Britannia in the early 60s, which is sort of like a satire on living in England in that time, which is wonderful. And a friend of mine, actually, David Boyle, who does one-man shows of both of them. So there is a sort of Jewish bizarre coziness about both Sellers and Newley, I think, isn't there? There's that sort of I don't know, it was that person that's not quite grown up, I suppose, and not quite found out where he's supposed to be in life. And
it's a good subject for a biopic, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still trying to pitch the definitive book, but I'm sure that's not going to happen now. But I mean, I don't know. It's an amazing life he had, and as we said before, he packed a lot in a relatively short time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just wonderful. I mean, I play his music a lot. I mean, I find it deserves, you know, regular listening because it's so multi-layered, and I watch his stuff a lot. I'm a huge fan of his. So it's such an exciting thing. I mean, obviously about Gurney Slade, but it's such a treat that you can actually now buy that and sit and watch the whole thing in your living room and enjoy it.
And it's been 50 years. Are there any other TV shows that he did that Network, do you think, could be could bring out? Is there anything that stands out in your mind?
TV series, really. I mean, he did one-off specials and those sort of things and guest appearances in other people's work, but he never did another TV show. He did various sort of spectacles and that sort of stuff, but no, not really. I mean, I think...
So maybe some of these sort of musical shows or something like the... The Anthony and Newley show, I think there was, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, I think so. I mean, ideally that would have been an extra on Gurney Slade. Or, I mean, there's so much stuff. I mean, God bless them. We've got to mention Dick Fiddy here because Dick Fiddy was the consultant for the TV Heaven season on Channel 4, and also wrote some wonderful sleeve notes for the Network DVD. And Dick is the sort of the John Huston of cult TV lovers, really, isn't he? He's our god, really.
He's great, and he comes out to Edinburgh every year for the TV festival, and I managed to bump into him, and he's just happy to chat about these things.
He's just a fan, like all of us. I mean, he loves it, you know. And the fact is that he's so excited when he finds these rarities or, you know, Missing Believe Wiped and stuff. But yeah, I mean, so we got a name check Dick because Dick was very much the force that got this on DVD in the first place. So yeah, it's wonderful stuff.
It must be really satisfying for him because you said earlier on that it was the surprise hit of the year in 2011. I take it did surprisingly well.
Well, it was like in the top 10 of DVD sales across the board for like 3 months, wasn't it, or something ridiculous? And this is for a 50-year-old black and white TV show.
How very wonderful.
Yeah. It made my year.
And I think it probably is a good sign that we will get more. Obviously, the network are going to keep going, but hopefully it's given them a bit of a confidence boost and a boost to the bank balance as well to keep going with this stuff. Because some of it, you think, how the hell are they going to make money on that?
It came at the point when they had the warehouse problem, didn't they? So a lot of the stock was destroyed. And
terrible timing.
Yeah, tragical because they couldn't even sell in tragic. I'm becoming a Del Boy here. It was tragic because they were supposed to have a huge batch of the DVDs to sell at the NFT event, and they weren't. The stock they had prepared was destroyed, so they couldn't sell them on the night. So the fact they sold so many when it was relaunched later that year pretty much kept them buoyant, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, thank God for Tony Newley and keeping Network floating. Really.
Absolutely.
How bizarre, eh? He's
well,
good old Tony.
Everything old is new again, isn't it? You know,
What's that line Marlene Dietrich does in Touch of Evil? It's so old it's new or something.
Yeah.
No, it's lovely. So should we round up? We've done over an hour there, and I'm sure that's far too much to...
Yeah, that's do. Fine.
Works for me.
Anybody's bladder lasts an hour and 5 minutes on Newly, I don't think.
I'm hungry, I want my dinner.
Oh, what a plaintive cry. Well, for the sake of Frank's dinner, I think we should probably wrap it up at this point.
It's in the dog, Frank, sorry.